Live from the Ken and Valerie Baker Studio at WHYY, this is Studio 2.
On Thursday, January 15th, welcome, 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 friends, on Into the Program. I'm Cherry Gregg.
And I'm Avi Wolfman-Arendt.
Today we are asking whether technology is making life too easy and if inconvenience, struggle, and intentional effort is the better road to fulfillment and happiness in life. Sounds pretty philosophical, right?
Yes.
But we want to explore this idea of friction maxing. It's the tongue-in-cheek term that sums up the idea that one should choose inconvenience over hyper-efficiency. And one of our producers got this idea for the show from a recent column in The Cut. They argue that modern-day technology like ChatGPT, DoorDash, even GLP-1s, are getting rid of our everyday discomfort and with them our capacity to think, to be patient, and to connect with other humans. So we're asking today whether it's time to reclaim friction individually or as a culture. And of course, we have some cool guests who are going to help us think through all of this. And we want to hear from you. Is modern technology making life too convenient? And what are you doing to disconnect from that technology and sort of reconnect with the world around you? The number is 888-477-9499. The email is studio2@whyy.org. And if you're watching on Facebook or YouTube, you can put comments in the chat. I do use a lot of technology, but
sure. And
I was joking. I was like, I go to the grocery store. I actually like going. And a lot of my friends just have their groceries delivered.
Yeah, yeah.
But I like, it makes me feel connected to the people. I want to see things on the shelves and touch them.
Do you use the self-checkout or do you go with the person?
The person.
You really go with the person?
I go with the person.
And sometimes that line is pretty long.
Yeah, well, it depends.
Yeah, there you go. That's the truth. There's
depends
the truth.
If I'm in a rush. But yeah.
And we're going to make you dial the whole number.
Yeah.
888-477-9. Back in
friction.
The, back in the day, if you wanted to reach Mike Jones, you had to call the number.
Yeah,
you know
that's
what
right.
I'm saying?
You had to call just push the button. You have them already in
888-477-9499. Email studio2@whyy.org. If you don't get the Mike Jones thing, don't worry about it. It's millennial stuff. We're also doing DJ of the Day.
DJ of the
Day. So we're
going to
end the program, as we do every Thursday, with a song picked by one of you on the topic of the show. And if you really want to keep with the spirit of the show, don't Google songs about friction. Try to think of one.
Yes.
In your
head. Don't ask ChatGPT,
y'all. Yeah, yeah. So obviously it has to be related to the theme of the show, technology, slowing down. I don't know. Whatever.
Analog worlds.
Analog worlds, maybe. Studio2@whyy.org. Get your submissions in by 12:30. And EP Kevin will pick one of you.
I look forward to hearing what song this will be.
Yeah, for sure. I have no idea where this
me
one's going.
Either.
Usually I know. I have a hint.
I have nothing that came to mind.
No,
yeah.
For me either. I do have three local news stories, however.
And
Avi,
you're kicking us off.
Yeah, so some breaking news this morning about yet another sports betting scandal, this one with ties to Philadelphia. We learned that federal prosecutors here in Philly have charged 20 people in a scheme that involves fixing basketball games. Mm. This scheme allegedly included professional gamblers, one former NBA player, and many college players, some of whom, according to the indictment, were paid to intentionally play poorly. This is often known as point shaving. Here's the Philly connections. One of the gamblers involved here is a local guy, Shane Heenan, who is a fixture at Rivers Casino here in Philadelphia, where apparently some of these bets were made. He was already implicated in a major betting scandal connected to another NBA player, Terry Rozier. Also, in this same indictment, if you can stay with me, there are allegations against a player or players, not quite sure yet, at LaSalle University in North Philadelphia. We don't know exactly how they were involved in this point-shaving scheme, but they are, according to the federal government, somehow involved.
Yeah, hundreds of thousands of dollars, according to reporting, was involved here. One alleged conspirator getting $200,000 to participate. Not one of the Philly folks, but
one
of the gamblers involved was bragging about all of this on social media.
Yeah, the Philly guy.
I'm like, what? Yes. And see, the whole thing, when I think about the amount of money involved, it's just so tempting, right?
Mm-hmm.
And that's how, you know, people are cheating and sort of getting these players involved because the money is there. And hopefully these high profile indictments will sort of discourage people from doing this.
Yeah.
Because now you're watching college sports, you're watching these games and you're thinking, is that missed shot a real missed shot?
Right.
Or
right.
are they point shaving?
That brick was a little bricky.
It was too bricky.
A little bricky.
Yeah. I don't know. Yeah. You know?
No, but it's interesting. We're talking about friction today, right? One of the issues is they've removed the friction that used to be there around sports betting. It's just so easy to do. At the same time, the argument that the folks who support legalized gambling will say is that it's easier to detect this stuff now because when they see or when the algorithm sees an unusual amount of betting on a random game or a random
That's
spread
a red flag, yeah.
or a random prop bet, they'll flag it immediately and then they can start an investigation. We have no idea. Are they just catching everyone right now?
Or was this always going on?
Yeah, we don't know. We don't know. We don't know how much of it they're catching right now. I mean, there's a lot of people being caught. There's another whole another scandal involving Temple University men's basketball that's not even connected to this one. But so a lot of people are getting in trouble, but it's possible they're catching everybody who's doing it, in which case then I guess the system is working. It's just hard to say.
Yeah, well, of course, there'll be more of these, I predict.
Yes. You would bet on that.
I could bet on that yeah.
All
for
right.
sure.
Story number two.
So there's a new sheriff in town in Bucks County. Newly elected Sheriff Danny Seisler says his office will no longer collaborate with Immigration, Customs, and Enforcement. The county is home to about 50,000 immigrant residents, and Seisler says that since the county began working with ICE, not one of those residents has felt comfortable calling 911 to report a crime or to ask for help for fear that they would be taken by federal authorities. He says that this has led to major concerns and he had to make a decision. Take a listen.
After careful evaluation, I have determined that the certain public safety costs of this ICE partnership are greatly outweighed by any potential public safety benefits that this partnership may offer. That is why this morning I signed an order terminating the 287G partnership between the Bucks County Sheriff's Office and ICE.
And so let me tell you what that means. That means that the Bucks County Sheriff's Office will no longer work with federal authorities to carry out certain ICE orders or activities. It also means that deputies are no longer going to be asking crime victims, witnesses, and court observers any questions about their immigration status. Seisler campaigned on this issue. He gained momentum in the sheriff's race. He ousted former Sheriff Fred Herron by a 10-point margin. And if you recall, Herron had signed an agreement with ICE that allowed his deputies to be federally trained and to collaborate with ICE in carrying out certain activities. And this became a flashpoint issue in that race.
Yeah, so it's kind of promises made, promises kept.
Yep.
Seisler said he was going to do this.
He did it.
If the folks in Bucks County elected him, and they did it. You know, he did walk a little bit of a fine line with this, saying we're not a sanctuary county, sort of rejecting
that. Made that clear.
Label. Yep. And then also he hit back at Philadelphia Sheriff Rochelle Bilal, who made noise recently for public comments about ICE and said that those comments, you know, were not warranted. So, you know, trying to strike, I suppose, more of a middle of the road tone while also, you know, upholding a policy promise.
That is true. And by the way, Seisler said that his office will only help ICE in detaining people who have committed, quote, serious crimes.
Right.
So he's still going to be there if someone, the worst of the worst, but just helping and doing things for low level folks who haven't really done anything. They're not going to be a participant in that.
Yeah. Finally, Cherry.
Yes.
I've got to tell you about one of my favorite new things that I found on the internet.
Okay.
It's an Instagram account called Faces of South Philly.
Oh.
And this account is just a bunch of portraits of people who passed through a South Philly hardware store at 5th and Porter decades ago.
Wow.
And they're just amazing, fascinating photos, people from every single walk of life. And the backstory here is equally cool. This store was called Bruskin Hardware and Lock. It was a family business in South Philly for three generations. The photos you see on the account were taken by the longtime owner of the store, Irv Bruskin. Kind of an eccentric guy, and one of his obsessions was photography, and he was a very friendly guy, and he convinced all of these customers to have their portraits taken by him. So Irv died in 2021, and his son Adam discovered a trove of over 7,000 portraits.
A lot of pictures.
Taken at this store in South Philly. And Adam spent over a year digitizing them, and now he's rolling them out on this Instagram account called faces of South Philly. So I just find it very endearing.
A lot of friction in honor of his
yes,
dad.
That's right.
Digitizing all those. By the way, the Faces of South Philly account is really cool. They have bad Santa photos, shirtless men, people with cigarettes in their mouth and bad glasses and bad haircuts.
You got
absolutely
all types of people in South Philly and you see them all on this account.
Types of people. Yeah. I just followed Faces of South Philly. Before me, it only has 60 followers.
Let's get that up.
Let's get that up. Because
well, one thing that would be nice is that there are these photos, but we don't know who they are. So if the account got big enough, people could say, that's my uncle, that's
yeah,
my
you might
aunt.
See a
you
family
might get some
members.
Backstory in there. And I have to say, if you've ever followed the South Street Sam Instagram account,
kind of similar.
It's
yeah.
sort of similar to that. It's like an analog version of that. So it would be cool to have like an old school companion to South Street
yeah.
Sam.
Yeah, Faces of South Philly.
Check it out.
Good. It'll definitely say,
But also
what?
Get off
what?
The internet and don't go on Instagram because that's the kind of topic of the show today.
Friction
Stay tuned.
Maxing.
This is Studio 2. And welcome back to Studio 2 on WHYY. I'm Avi Wolfman-Arendt.
And I'm Cherry Gregg. Earlier this month, a columnist at The Cut named Catherine Jezer Morton published a piece lamenting modern conveniences and the ease with which technology allows us to mentally check out. She argues that by opting for the quickest road to satisfaction, we're often missing out on the messiness, you know, the friction, the good stuff.
Now, her solution is something called friction maxing. That means writing the old email instead of using ChatGPT. Maybe calling or texting a friend instead of referencing their permanently saved location on your phone.
Mm-hmm.
Or maybe even, and this is dramatic, going a whole bus ride without
what?
Looking at or listening to anything just to see what happens when you don't put your blinders on.
Joining us today is a writer who has been thinking about the human consequences of technology for 20 years, and not just in recent history. All the way back in 2008, he wrote a piece in The Atlantic called "Is Google Making Us Stupid?" Nicholas Carr is the author of many books, including The Shallows, What the Internet is Doing to Our Brains, and most recently, Super Bloom, How Technologies of Connection Tear Us Apart. Welcome to the show, Nick.
Thank you. Good to be here.
It's great to have you. It's also great to have our listeners. We'd love to hear from you today. A couple questions headed your way as well. Is modern technology making life too convenient? What are you doing to disconnect? Give us a call, 888-477-9499 on that phone thing you have in your hands. Also, email studio2 at whyy.org, YouTube, Facebook. How you doing? Drop a comment in the chat.
And so, Nick, I mean, you've written for years about how technology changes how we think. When you hear the term friction maxing, what resonates with you and what makes you skeptical?
Well, I'm generally in favor of the concept, but it's not as if everything we do has to be hard. The technology plays a very important role in making kind of routine, difficult things that aren't particularly important to us, making them easier. And that's great generally. And that's what, you know, technology has done in the Industrial Revolution, in the computer age and so forth. But the problem is that we become dependent on software and our phones and our computers for very intimate, very human activities, you know, talking to one another, building relationships with one another, expressing ourselves, even kind of developing a sense of self. Increasingly, we go through software, and whether it's for an industrial process or relationship building, software is designed to reduce effort. And yet it's the effort often for many things in our lives that makes those activities satisfying. And so because we just reach for the phone now for everything, we're not making careful decisions about, you know, when should I make effort? When should I have friction in my life? Because that's more satisfying. We just go the easy route.
Can you give us some examples? Yeah. And maybe it's one on each side of something that you're like, I'm fine with taking a shortcut here or leaning into the convenience of completing this task versus here's a task where I would rather do it the hard way or the old way.
Yeah. So this is something that I and probably other people have started to think about, which is doing your taxes for the year. Right. And a lot of us now get software program or go online and do it through our computer or even our phone. And it seems to me that, you know, I'm happy that I can do that. I don't have to do all the calculations that the IRS makes you do and subtract this and divide by this and stuff, take percentages of that. If the computer wants to do that for me, I'm fine with that, because it's going to free me. It's going to actually free up a lot of time from doing taxes, which is not the most enjoyable activity I have. But there's all sorts of places, I think, today where more efficiency is just wrong. And we're certainly seeing it now with AI, with chatbots. So a lot of people, instead of reading a book or a long article, will simply ask for a summary from AI. And you get it very quickly. It's, you know, half decent. You'll get a general sense of what the thing is about. But what we know about how our minds work, how memory works, is that if you actually sit down with a piece of writing, a good piece of writing, and force yourself to actually read every word, to try to, you know, screen out distractions so you're really concentrating, you end up with a much deeper memory of what you've read, which means you have much more knowledge that you've gained from it, and you often discover this is quite a pleasurable activity. So I think you can see this with a lot of things, from, you know, the way we, as I said, the way we read, the way we communicate with each other. You know, back when I was a kid, if there was somebody who was far away, you actually had to sit down and take out a pen and write a letter and put it in an envelope, put a stamp on it, pay for the stamp, put it in your mailbox, and then wait a long time for the reply. And today that seems kind of strange, but actually it's quite satisfying. And you used to really look forward to receiving letters from friends who had moved away or whatever. Now, you know, we went from that to email, which was much quicker. And now we go to texting. And so you just, you know, you let the text app, you know, auto-complete your thoughts, tell you which emojis to use. It's kind of you're industrializing the way you talk to each other, and it's much more efficient, but ultimately it's much more shallow, I think, and much less satisfying.
And so, Nick, you know, I have a young person in my household who abhors friction and who tries to do everything possible to avoid it, and, you know, says, you know, I'm like, you gotta talk to people, and, well, it's awkward, it's weird, and, you know, that's friction, right? So can you sort of try to explain people all the ways that friction actually exists, and how, you know, it could be a good thing? Because sometimes, you know, when you first meet people, it is awkward, but you get through the awkward to get to familiarity, right? So that's a good friction to kind of go through. So make the case to some of these folks who are just they do their existence is to avoid friction at all costs.
Yeah. You know, so friction takes many forms. It can be having to pay for something instead of getting it free. It can be, you know, having to make a physical or mental effort rather than letting software do it. It can be, as you were talking about, you know, actually going out somewhere to meet somebody and talk to them in person rather than shooting text back and forth. So friction takes many, many forms, and it's all about just added effort or added cost, not just monetary cost, but cost in time and stuff. And I think what most of us know, even though we might not admit it to ourselves a lot, is that one of the most fulfilling things we can do as people is to master a difficult skill. And that can be public speaking. It can be a skill at work. It can be building a cabinet. It can be deer hunting. It can be playing a violin. You know, it's something that's hard to do and hard to master. But once you accomplish it, once you put in the time and the effort, once you go through all that friction, you start to have mastery of it. And that's very fulfilling. And so I think we're too quick to say, oh, let's just get rid of the friction. Let's make everything easy. And things are easy, and we get them done more quickly, but you end up feeling unsatisfied because you haven't really made any effort. You haven't developed the skills. And I think if we could just if we could be aware that there are times when it is good for things to be easy, but there are also times when human satisfaction comes from actually making an effort. And it's, we've been seduced by our phones and by the companies that give us our apps to forget that fact. And I think it would be good to start relearning.
Yeah. Let me read this comment from Alex and Drescher, who says, I recently watched the movie WALL-E for the first time. It seems to foreshadow where we are heading because it depicts humans exiled from a destroyed Earth, but the humans have everything done for them. They don't do anything. They don't think, move, even feed themselves. And they become happy blobs having an easy life. This movie was from 2008, almost 20 years ago. Same year as that article you wrote about whether Google is making us stupid, Nick. So interesting timing there.
Right.
Here's the pushback that I often hear from people when we have this conversation, though, is that there has always been this panic and this worry whenever new technologies come onto the scene that we're going to take the easy way out and we're going to forget how to do things we once knew how to do and we're going to stop appreciating those things we used to do. And one of the classic examples, I know you've written about this, it was Socrates, right, who was like worried about, I think, the written word and it was what it was going to do to oral traditions and storytelling. And of course, the written word did in some ways diminish oral traditions, but it also unlocked a whole new box of creativity and other new hard tasks for humans to accomplish. And like, why won't that happen again with the technology of today?
You know, and I think that's a good point. And you never know if what you're seeing immediately in the present is going to look very, very different 20 years or a century from now. But I think what's happened that's very, very different is that now we have this little device called our phone that is with us all the time and is a multi-purpose device that can that can assume a take over a lot of the effort involved in thinking, in reading, in expressing ourselves, in talking with other people, in making sense of the world. And we've never had that in the past. This is, you know, you used to use automation technologies, you know, technologies that take the friction out of something for a particular job at work or for a particular thing you had to do that was a difficult and that, you know, you wanted to get through it quickly. These were specialized tools that we used in kind of isolated ways and usually with some thoughtfulness about how we were using them. Now we have this multi-purpose, extremely fast, extremely efficient tool connected to, you know, a universe of information.
Yeah.
So it becomes just much, much easier to offload pretty much everything.
I think what you're saying is it's too powerful. Maybe it's too much too fast.
It applies the same kind of industrial logic that everything has to be fast. Everything has to be easy. Everything has to be high volume. And it applies it across the board to everything we do. And in fact, there are a lot of things we do that we'd be happier if we did make a little effort, spend a little more time and had a little more inefficiency and friction.
Yeah. By the way, we would love to hear from you, our listeners. The questions of the day: is modern technology making life too convenient? And what are you doing to disconnect from that technology? The number is 888-477-9499. The email is studio2@whyy.org. And if you're watching on Facebook or YouTube, you can leave your comments in the chat. Chris from Pennsport says, I recently installed a free app blocking app on my phone that I have configured to block social media and other distracting apps for most of the workday. Now, when I catch myself casually checking social media during a down moment, I'm reminded to redirect my attention back to a work-related task. It's honestly been life-changing for the better. So Chris is using technology to keep him from the technology. Let's bring in Kelly from Hopewell Township, New Jersey. Kelly, you're on Studio 2. What's your question or comment?
Hi. I just wanted to share three ways that I actually have created more friction in my life and the benefits of them. So one is simple, very simple. I grate my own cheese, and it was sort of one of those eureka moments. I was in the middle of baking bread, and it said, don't use pre-shredded cheese. And I was like, well, why is that? Because, of course, it has a non-caking agent in it. And I said, oh, wow. You know, so there's the upside of that. And the second one is, you know, I was a journalist for 20 years. I worked in New York, and when I finally got laid off from the last job, you know, I remember a lot of conversations with the editor saying, why don't you use AI? You know, you'd be a lot faster. But since I've gotten laid off, you know, and I freelance here and there, I enjoy slow ideation. I have had creative blocks, and I just lean into them, and I feel like my ideas are a lot better. Wow. And then the third one is, and I heard you say you have kids at home, so this is the dishwasher broke like 2-3 years ago, and I didn't get it fixed. I saved money, and now the kids grumble, but we have the best conversations while they're doing the dishes, and we get silly in the kitchen together. So.
I love that. That's Kelly from Hopewell Township.
I don't know if I could do that last one, but it's. I love that it's working for you. Yeah. God, I love my dishwasher so much.
And yeah, I love. I do wash it. I feel like I do. I wash my pots and pans. I love that. I don't know what it is with my little gloves. Anyway, I wanted to sort of ask you, Nick, about, you know, the difference between knowing you can do something and then using the whole convenience thing, because I think people with young folks in their life, you just want to make sure that they can do it, right? And then sometimes you may opt for the more convenient route versus the friction. And it's just like, sort of, do you go through the checkout aisle use the more convenient, quicker route with the self-checkout? Like, is there sort of like a difference between knowing you can do the thing with friction, but then every once in a while you use the more convenient, you know, tech hack?
Absolutely. In fact, I think one of the, when we think about friction or automation or anything, one way to think about it is that it's okay to automate a routine, an activity after you've mastered it. Mm-hmm. Whereas if you just, you know, go to the machine and never learn how to do it, then you steal from yourself the opportunity to engage with the world in some way that you didn't before. And I'll give you a specific example that applies to kids in particular, but it's from, you know, a few decades ago, which is when in schools they started letting kids use calculators in math. And there were two camps, just as we're seeing today with AI, by the way. One that said, oh, kids aren't going to be able to learn basic arithmetic, they're never going to master that. And then the other camp said, well, this will make things faster, they'll get the answers right, it'll make everything quicker. And what we found, if you go back and look at what actually happened, is that there are two very different ways to introduce a calculator into math. First, you have the kids master the basic arithmetic or math process that they're learning. And then once they've really mastered it, you let them use the calculator to speed up that particular task. And that way, that gives them a basis where they can go up to the next level of math and to the next and to the next and the next. And you know, take friction out once you've mastered it. And I think that's a good way to think about the use of technology. It's, yeah, wait. Make the effort to master something, whether it's grating cheese or baking bread or anything, because that does, you often learn when you make that kind of effort that, hey, this is enjoyable. This could be part of my life. Maybe I should bake bread. Whereas if you never even try it, you never learn whether this might be a good addition to your life.
A lot of people are writing in with their tips, and a lot of it just does have to do with physical separation from phone, or like the other person wrote in, talking about using technology to block their own phone. Sherry says, I love when I leave the house and forget my phone. I almost never go back, so I can feel like I'm getting a real break from it and reorient to life phone free. Mm-hmm. Eric from Philly says, when I practice music, I put my phone down, place it in another room so I don't get distracted. I even set a timer for when I can pick it up again. I will speak personally. Yesterday, there was a huge Verizon outage. I couldn't use my phone while I was waiting for a pizza. And I did a little people watching. I don't know if it was life-changing, but, you know, I noticed the difference for sure. Let's bring in another caller. This is Steve from Reading, Pennsylvania. Steve, you're on Studio 2. What's your question or comment?
Actually, I had two very quick comments. One is, when Google started, my kids were fairly young, 8 or 10, and I would make them race me. I would try to think if I could find the answer before they could Google it. But that only lasted about a year, and then I lost every time. But what the real thing was GPS. I have a GPS kind of in my head, and once I started using GPS, I couldn't remember how to get places anymore because I stopped thinking it through. So I stopped using GPS, except for, you know, long.
Oh, there you go.
Steve
sometimes
from
technology Reading. Fails. There you go. There's Steve from Reading. Let me ask you about, as we're getting toward the end of this segment, Nick, curious about, so like the general march of human history is toward more convenience, and humans, I think, mostly reflexively accepting that convenience and being quite pleased with it. Are there examples, though, from history where people have truly pushed back at scale against convenience, and maybe examples that you would say we should learn from?
Yeah, I mean, to be frank, there aren't all that many examples, because as you say, human beings, frankly, are pretty naturally lazy. if a machine will do something for you, you tend to become dependent on it very quickly. But there are moments when we've seen cultural changes that push back against technology. And I'll give you one example. Back in the 60s and early 70s, there was this huge push for highly processed foods. It was caught up with technological progress. The astronauts were going into space and, you know, squeezing tubes of food or drinking Tang instead of orange juice. And so there was this feeling that, oh, we can just have everything processed for us. You just go out and buy something, you know, a TV dinner or something frozen and whatever. And that was a big movement in society to get rid of, you know, fresh produce and stuff, because you have to actually cook it and learn how to cook it. But what we saw is people came to realize that not only were there health problems that came from an over reliance on processed foods, but there was a loss of taste, a loss of enjoyment in cooking and eating. And so we saw, I mean, there's still a lot of processed foods around, but we did see a movement back to, you know, cooking, back to fresh produce, back to, you know, baking your own bread, organic foods and stuff. So it was this technological push that said, oh, we can make it everything easier. And people found there are drawbacks, and we moved a little backwards. Yeah. That's rare, but it does happen.
We have a frequent commenter in this show who goes by the name Slow Food. I'm curious if he'll chime in or if he's listening today.
I'd love to hear from Slow Food on that. And we're going to be talking about to a local expert who has been teaching this for about 20 years.
Yeah, and pondering this question, what does religion and monasticism have to teach us about how to have a more meaningful life? We're going to have that conversation. Nick's going to stick around. You're listening to Studio 2 on WHYY. Don't go anywhere. And welcome back to Studio 2 on WHYY. I'm Avi Wolfman-Arendt.
And I'm Cherry Gregg. Today we're talking about friction maxing, the idea that resisting modern conveniences might lead to more meaningful lives. Nicholas Carr is here with us. He is a best-selling author who has been writing about the human consequences of technology for 20 years.
And now we'd like to bring in another perspective into the conversation. Justin McDaniel is the chair of the Religious Studies Department at the University of Pennsylvania, and he spent years teaching students how to friction max, although he might call it by another term. Justin, welcome to the show.
Thank you so much. I'm happy to be here.
Yes, and to our listeners at home, on the road, or elsewhere, our questions for you this hour are, is modern technology making life too convenient, and what are you doing to disconnect from that technology? The number is 888-477-9499. The email is studio2@whyy.org. And if you're watching on YouTube or Facebook, keep those comments coming in the live chat.
Justin, we've kind of teased what your thing is, but we haven't really described it. So you teach, I think it's multiple classes right at the University of Pennsylvania that put some of these ideas into practice. One, do I have the title right? It's Existential Despair.
That's the name of the class.
Yeah. And another called Living Deliberately.
That's right.
Okay. So describe these two classes to folks. What do students get when they take these classes?
They're a little controversial, a little strange. Actually, Existential Despair, my first class of the semester, was last night. So we ended at midnight last night. So the class is 5 to midnight once a week. So it's a 7-hour class. It used to be an 8-hour class, but they switched our schedule. And we come together, and I collect their cell phones in a box. They have no syllabus. They have no idea what's going to happen in the class. And I hand them all a novel. And each week it's going to be a different novel. And we sit down and we read that novel in silence, cover to cover. They're not allowed to take notes. About 300 pages, 320 pages. And they're not allowed to take any notes. They can have a journal to write in afterwards. And then afterwards, about 10 o'clock, we have an intense discussion to 2 hours in the pitch dark about that novel.
And so what's the purpose? What is your intention having these students do this? Not having a syllabus, they got to come in and be present. What are you hoping that they take from this?
There's lots of reasons. One, that modern students, especially at a kind of an elite place like, or even at an elite place like Penn, rarely read a book cover to cover anymore. This was a very common thing to do, that you would go to a beach or you go to a library and you would read. And I find students get AI summaries of things, they read short excerpts of things, and they think they know something. And so it's all about knowledge to them, acquiring knowledge. But the process of going through emotions, the process of sitting with boredom, the process of sitting with sadness, the process of sitting with joy, and actually feeling that and often feeling it through a character. The most ways we generally get it nowadays are through film, but film, in a sense, even students don't see full films anymore. Yeah. They're seeing a lot of clips now. And so that process of slowly, slowly watching a character develop and not turning away when you get uncomfortable with a part of a book, when you get sad, not just picking up a cell phone, not, or in my time we would pick up a cigarette, you know what I mean, like it, yeah. Mm-hmm. Or pace or something like that. And the students obviously can do those things. They can pace and things like that, but to stick with it. And it's transformative. I've been doing this for 22 years and version of these courses, and that students tell me that they've returned to a love of reading, that they slow down and that they incorporate in lives. I have students 20 years ago that I'll still email, and they have kids now and married, and they'll tell me that like this has become almost a Sabbath to them. Mm. You know, that reading alone or taking time away from technology and doing that in a community with others. And so we've started reading groups all over the country and then even online where people just come together in silence to process things, and process often things that are very difficult. And I tell the students that like these are largely free resources. I mean, Ben Franklin started the free library in the city of Philadelphia, is that you can have access to millions and millions of books. And it's a great technology. The codex of the book is one of the greatest technologies humans have ever invented. And that this small rectangle that can, in a sense, teach you and give you therapy about your life. And that I'm concerned with my students, not now, like not at 19, 20. They mm-hmm. have a lot of hope. They have a lot of aspiration. Certainly they have problems, and everybody has problems. But I'm concerned of them as they move forward in life, that when their marriages might fail, or when their careers don't work out the way they want them to, or when they have sickness or their parents pass away, things like this, is that they'll have these resources and this quiet, and they'll be able to sit with quiet and just to draw on a novel or draw on a memory and work through that slowly instead of reacting very quickly.
But how many people want to take the class?
Last, we had 504 applicants.
For how many spots?
For 40.
Oh,
and
wow.
And I interviewed 417 individuals.
Has the popularity of the class changed over time? I'm just
It's getting more and more popular.
More popular.
Every year.
And how about the students' relationship to the class? Has that changed over time? Like, are they, you called it a type of Sabbath. Is it like is the contrast between that Sabbath and their lives bigger now than it was 20 years ago?
Absolutely. Especially after COVID. Where everything moved online for a lot of them for a while, and for, you know, most of us for a while, and that it's very difficult. They're expected to be online all the time now. And so, like, I collected their cell phones last night, put them in my office while they read, and my whole office was buzzing because all their phones were constantly buzzing in
That's
this box because they forgot to turn them off, right? And that it's just like, oh my God, these kids either have a lot of friends or a lot of pressure that they're doing that. But then I looked at my phone. I'm like, well, I got a kind of a lot of text in that time too. So
all those notifications.
Exactly.
Brian from Morristown says the brain is just like any other muscle or organ in the body. Use it or lose it. The internet and social media make finding solutions to problems easier rather than figuring it out on your own.
Absolutely.
And I wonder, you interview all these students, and I just wonder, what are you talking about? What is their pitch for, like, why they should be in the class? What are they seeking?
Well, see, I don't let them pitch.
You don't let them pitch?
No. Students and everybody, we're all applied for jobs and got jobs, are used to self-curate and self-present all the time, right? And your elevator pitch or whatever you want to say. I don't let them tell me their majors, their backgrounds, their skills, their interests. I have no idea what their resume is, and I do not care. I give them a poem. I ask them to read the poem and tell me about it. And all I want is different personalities in the room. Mm-hmm. I want different, some are eager, some are shy, some are bombastic, some are evasive. I want that mix of personalities in a room.
So what's your perception of what they're seeking? Like, and do they seem to get it when they take this class?
They're seeking, I mean, lots of different things, but they're seeking in a sense of presence.
Yeah.
A presence with other human beings in a shared task that doesn't have a defined outcome. Mm. That it's not about profit. It's not about accomplishment. It is about the kind of really about 75, 80% of our life that we're not working, right? Those hours that you are falling in love, those hours that you are taking walks, they want to, in a sense, be present in these moments, and they can't be present anymore,
yeah.
Right? Is that they, whether it's shopping or whether it's playing sports or whether it's going out to dinner, is that they're constantly pulled from the present where they are. I mean, I was at the dinner the other night, and there was two people clearly on a first date, and they were both on their cell phones, yeah. Right? Yeah. And they weren't present with each other. Maybe they didn't like each other. I don't know. But like this idea is that, well, we're not actually eating the meal. We're in the past. We're in the future. We're in other rooms. We're constantly there. You know, I was on a plane with my daughter. We were in Morocco. And like we were in the Sahara Desert 2 weeks ago in the Sahara Desert. And people were, in a sense, watching videos on their phone in the yeah. desert. I mean, we're under a full moon in the Sahara. And you're not actually there.
Yeah.
And so that I think the students really want to be at a place where they are and just experiencing something together. And the slow turning of pages, and that's all you're hearing, is very powerful to them.
Sammy Shatcha on YouTube says, I'm in my 20s and I had to buy a brick, lol. It allows you to hard restrict certain apps and sites with a phone tap of the brick. I do it when I go out and want to be more present in the world.
One of my closest friends just got one of those.
Oh, really? Yeah. Another YouTube watcher, Delft Punk, says, I wish someone would collect my cell phone. And Bobby Cohen on YouTube says, I find that chatting on the phone with a friend is satisfying. I get tired of just texting when misinterpretation is possible. Mm-hmm. I think the scary part for me is when you feel like you can't disconnect, Nick, bringing Nick Carr back into the conversation. Mm-hmm. Like, I guess I don't mind intellectually having the distraction of the phone. I kind of feel like I need it sometimes. But I guess it is scary to think, like, I don't know how to pull away from it, or I can't. In a moment, like if I was in Morocco. But I'm also a little skeptical I imagine human beings have always been distracted by things, which are maybe in our nature on some level. Like, do you feel like there's evidence to say people definitely are more distracted or less present, however one might scientifically define that, Nick?
Well, I think there's plenty of evidence, and I would not dismiss just anecdotal evidence, just looking around and, you know, seeing people in the Sahara on their phone, because you see that all the time. And human beings are naturally distractible creatures. And in fact, some scientists believe our seeking instinct, seeking new information, is one of our strongest instincts, because you can understand how we, like other mammals, stay alive by knowing whatever's going on in our environment. But what the internet does, and what social media does, and what our phones do, is they put us into an environment, because we have the phone there all the time with us, most people do. They put us in an environment where there's no end of new stuff to look at.
Yeah.
So we're constantly seeking, we're constantly seeking novelty, and we're drawn to that. And so, you know, as the professor was saying, what's stolen from us is our ability to actually distance ourselves from those distractions, which we used to be able to do. You didn't carry your TV around with you all day long, and have opportunities to kind of, you know, slow down, think carefully, read carefully, talk carefully. And with this new digital environment around us, we just don't have that those kind of downtime. So you have to kind of force yourself to do it now.
I started a meditation practice about 5 or 6 years ago, and went to a silent retreat. And you had to be quiet for 2 days. You had to eat in silence. All you heard was people crunching on whatever. And when I left, it was like I felt so good for a couple of weeks. Like, I just, you know, because you work in the news, you're constantly bombarded by notifications. And I just wonder, Justin, sort of, you know, it was like a religious experience to have that silence. And so I wonder, like, in religion, people's religious practices sort of incorporate friction. Can you talk about why this is and how this idea of having it be a practice where friction is involved sort of makes you, I guess, better and more connected to the world around you.
That's great you did that. I used to be a Buddhist monk, and we meditated for, you know, all day for...
I only did, you know, 2 days. That's all I did, yeah, Justin.
I did the whole shave head thing and living in the jungle. But I'm actually going on a retreat in a couple months of one like this, too, and I do it often. I think it's wonderful. And religion is where we're drawing a lot of this from, the history of monasticism. And a lot of this is drawn on kind of different ways of seeking pleasure. I think that people think that monks and nuns, this is somehow this austere life of no pleasure. But if you actually talk to monks and nuns, it's a heightened happiness that they're feeling. Yeah. And it's the happiness in the Latin tradition or the Catholic tradition we would call otium. And that is this kind of pleasure and contentment that comes from slow tasks, gardening, meditation, cooking, slicing, cutting, carving, even making soap, making liquor in the traditions to do that, and flower arranging, all of these things. There's what we call otium, and that's very different from lacere. And lacere is like license, like this idea that we're free to do anything. It's hedonistic and which is quick pleasure and just, you know, dopamine hits, right? And then there's also accidia, and accidia is like where we get accident from, meaning idleness, right? It's just like laziness and idleness. And so if you're seeking a kind of a sustained contentment, you want to go for this otium. You want to go for this. It's labor, that it's work that is purposeful and slow, but in a sense, and doesn't have an end in mind. Mm-hmm. That's why I always say when we study religion, we shouldn't study religion as compared to history or literature or political science. We should study as compared to cooking or music or art. Mm. It's because that's what people seek for in religion. They're seeking what they seem out of the painting. You don't get to the end of playing music. You don't get to the end of painting. Artists and musicians and dancers always want to keep perfecting their craft with no end in sight.
Mm. Yeah. I think we have time to squeeze in one more caller who has a thought on religion's intersection with all of this, I believe. Mm. This is Iban from Germantown. You're on Studio 2. Real quick, what's your question or your insight?
Oh, I just love this topic. It's just making my hair regrow. You know, I taught at the Media Lab when it began, and I was a student there, and they whisked me in because I like to talk a lot. So I'll try to keep this short. At the Media Lab, we did this exercise with students where I had them in an anechoic chamber. No sound. It was hugely buffered, and you couldn't hear anything except your own breathing, the sound of your blood, the wheezing of your brain. And it was a meditative thing. But the point is that it's not, friction maxing. It's sensuality maxing. Mm. And it's building communion, not just with other humans, but with nature, with the entire environment. Mm. This is something that the Brooklyn Immersionists did in Williamsburg, Brooklyn, 30 years ago. We had a whole community that changed from postmodernism, which is a distancing from reality, to a complete communion with a burned-out neighborhood. And we actually revived the whole neighborhood until the corporate real estate people took it over. But it was an amazing process of complete communion with an entire neighborhood, with our, you know, interdisciplinary art forms in the abandoned warehouses. But that is communion, and it really should be sensuality maxing.
Yeah. Well, thank you so much for that comment. And we're getting toward the end here, but real quick, Nick, I know you're very open about I haven't figured this out. It's not like I'm living a distraction-free life, but just curious what you have tried to do in your life over the last 20 years and maybe what's stuck, and we only have about 45 seconds, to try to get you closer to this ideal.
And I still struggle, but a couple of things. One is I've reduced my use of social media because I think social media, for all sorts of reasons, grabs our attention because we're social beings. And second, we as soon as we all started getting smartphones, for some reason we all decided we have to have them on our person all day long. And I think just the act, and we've talked about this earlier, just the act of leaving it behind when you go out to dinner or go for a walk or do other things is a very, very good discipline to try to master.
Yeah. Well, thank you so much. That was Nicholas Carr. His new book is Superbloom: How Technologies of Connection Tear Us Apart, available anywhere you buy books, I suppose. And we also have Justin McDaniel, professor of religious studies at the University of Pennsylvania. He also has a new book out called Cosmologies and Biographies, Siamese Manuscripts of Death, Time, and the Body. And if you want to take one of those classes at Penn, folks, you got to get in line. Justin, thanks so much for your time today.
Thanks
on
so
Studio
much.
2. And thank you, Nick, by the way, as well.
Yeah, and by the way, your class seems like it's really, really cool, by the way. And now it is time to reveal our Studio 2 DJ of the Day song selection. Al, hit it.
Whoa, it's a crazy world we're living in, and I just can't see that half of us immersed in sin is all we have to give these futures.
And that is Virtual Insanity by Jamiroquai from 1996.
It's a good pick. Can I read this comment real quick from Lauren in Haddonfield, because it's on the topic of music. Lauren has two girls under the age of 10. Says they really enjoy all listening to music together, but they usually ask Spotify or Alexa to make a playlist. Lauren said that began to feel empty, so she got a record player and they're listening to B-sides now, hoping that Friction will develop a deeper appreciation for music and its evolution. Love that comment from Lauren in Haddonfield.
I love that. By the way, you may remember the music video for this song of a staple of late 90s MTV. The singer was dancing in a small room as it seemed the floor was moving underneath him. True to Friction Maxing philosophy. Yeah, no trickery in this video. Love that. By the way, thank you so much to our producers, Debbie Builder, Andreas Copes, and Hazel Mae Bryan. Mike Schiffler is our visual producer. Al Banks and Tina Calique engineered today's show. Our executive producer is Kevin McCrory. The audio general manager is Joan Isabella. From Studio 2 here at WHYY in Philly, I'm Cherry Gray.
And wait, we got to thank YouTube regular David B.
Oh, yeah.
For being our DJ of the day. Thanks, David. I'm
Avi. Didn't thank David. Thank you.
We will talk to you next week.